Welcome to the Scottsdale Big Book Study, where we will study the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today's date is Saturday, March 2nd, 2024. My name is Dottie, and I'm a grateful compulsive overeater from New Jersey. I will be your host for today's study. Our co-host is Nancy J. If you have any questions during the meeting, please contact either myself or any of the co-hosts by private message in the chat function. The chat function will be disabled until 5 minutes before the question and answer session. Please note that the speaker, Harlan G., will be recorded for the duration of the meeting. However, the question and answer session, which follows, will not be recorded. We ask if you can please make sure to keep your microphone on mute at all times during today's study. And also, please turn off your video if you're exercising, eating, or if you need to stay away from your screen for any reason. During the meeting, we will post the link to our seventh tradition. This money goes toward the cost of our Zoom account, the cost of uploading our recordings, and we also will also send contributions to our intergroup and WSO. We will post the link to the previous week's recordings. These are available by clicking on the link that will be posted in the chat box. And now it is an honor and a privilege, and I'm very grateful to turn the meeting over to Harlan G.
Thank you, Dottie. Thank you very much. Couple of things before we get started. Number one, on March the 10th, which is 1 week from tomorrow, on March the 10th, if you are in the state of Arizona, this meeting will begin 1 hour earlier every Saturday morning. In other words, instead of 11 a.m., it'll begin at 10 a.m. because I change so the rest of the world does not have to on Saturday morning. Our evening meetings, that's Sunday through Friday, will begin 1 hour later, unless you're in the state of Arizona, in which case it'll be the same. Next Sunday is the beginning, once again, of daylight savings time, hence the hullabaloo. Also, one very quick announcement. If you like these big book studies, which I assume you do or you wouldn't be here, on July the 12th, the 13th, and the 14th, we're going to be doing one live and in person here in Arizona, in Phoenix, at the Crown Plaza Hotel. And that is going to take place Friday night, Saturday all day, Sunday morning. That's the 12th, the 13th, and the 14th of July here in Phoenix, Arizona. So we're hoping that you can make it. One other piece of information is the group conscience has spoken, and we're not going to keep any of the postings for meetings that are at the same time as our Scottsdale meetings. So if you're posting meetings that are at the same time as our meetings, you have to know that somebody from our group is going to delete them. So don't be posting meetings that are at the exact same time as our Scottsdale meetings. Okay, this morning we are going to discuss some very deep and important history of this fellowship. For thousands of years, it was thought that alcoholism was an untreatable condition. Doctors wanted no part of it because they had had no success in treating it. Theologians, clergy people, wanted no part of it because they felt they weren't getting anywhere in the treatment of alcoholism at all. And it was thought that alcoholism was a lack of willpower. Now, see if this rings true, because for me it does, what I was told my whole life. A lack of willpower, a lack of character, laziness, stupidity, lack of caring about loved ones. If you cared about your mother, you wouldn't eat this way. If you cared about your father, you wouldn't eat this way. And on and on and on. Now, I heard that my whole life. I heard that my entire life. And Bill Wilson was informed when he was in the town's hospital on his first hospitalization in April of 33, that he was told by Dr. Silkworth, although he had been seriously ill bodily and mentally, that he were that he was sick. He was told that he was sick, and he was told that where alcohol is concerned, the will is amazingly weakened. He says on page 7, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally, bodily being the allergy, mentally the twist. Now, Silkworth wasn't certain that Bill was an alcoholic at this time, but when he comes back to the hospital 1 year later in April of 34, Dr. Silkworth is going to tell Lois that Bill Wilson is indeed a hopeless alcoholic, and he tells Lois, you're going to have to give him over to the insane asylum or the undertaker, that there was nothing that could be done for any alcoholic. There just was nothing that could be done. And Bill Wilson goes home from the hospital after his second hospitalization. And on Armistice Day, 1934, which is November 11th, he will begin drinking again and trigger the allergy. And now he has been given the opinion of Dr. Silkworth that you are an alcoholic. There's nothing we can do for you. Could you imagine yourself going to a doctor because of your obese condition or your anorexic condition or your sorry, your bulimic condition, and the doctor tells you flat out, we're either going to have to put you in the insane asylum or you're going to die. Just think about how that would make you feel. I know when I was given these death sentences by these doctors, all it made me do was want to go eat because I became very helpless very quickly. And I didn't like that feeling. And I was angry and I was scared. And out of that alloy of anger and fear, I would eat anything I could get my hands on. It was just absolutely crazy how much I would eat when these things would happen to me. Now, before we begin, we're going to begin on page 8 at the very bottom of the page where it says, my musing was interrupted by the telephone. I'm going to give you some background as to things that have happened. And Bill Wilson is aware of some of them, but not all of them. And what I would like you to do in your mind, is I would like you to go to Rhode Island. And in Rhode Island, we are going to look in on a drunk. We're going to look in on an alcoholic, and his name is Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard is an alcoholic, and he is very wealthy. His family came here in the later part of the 1600s, in the 15th century. He is the child and grandchild and great-grandchild and whatever, up to several generations. He is their child who is not only alcoholic, but they are wealthy industrialists. They own a company called Burlington Mills. And if you've ever walked on a carpet in your life, chances are excellent that the carpet that you are walking on is indeed a Burlington carpet. And they also were major stockholders in another company that is to this day still traded on the New York Stock Exchange, and it is called Allied Chemical. And today, Allied Chemical is still traded, and the Hazard family at that time were major stockholders. I don't know that they still are or not. I don't know. But what I can say is at that time, they definitely were major stockholders. Now, Roland desperately wanted to show his mother and father before he died that he could get sober. And he had himself sequestered on a Caribbean island. And the quartermaster that came to bring him the supplies was instructed not to bring him any alcohol at all whatsoever. And he didn't. And for 1 year during the 1920s, he remained sober. He comes off that island, and the first place that he stopped on his way to go back to Rhode Island after a year of not drinking, he figures he's cured. He figures this is it. He's cured. That's it. He goes to Miami, which is the first stop on the way back to getting to Rhode Island. And he goes to Miami, and what do they have in Miami? Bars, liquor, you name it. So he goes to Miami, he sees bars, he figures he's going to stop in and just have a couple of drinks. After all, he's been sober a year. He's proven that he's not an alcoholic. He's going to have one or two. He has a drink, then two, then three, then, a million. And at the bottom line is that he is now drunk as hell and he can't even walk. He's so drunk. Now, in its infancy, at that time in the 1920s, the art of psychiatry was in its infancy. And you see, we think of psychiatry as being centuries old. That is not true. Sigmund Freud at that time was the preeminent psychiatrist in the world. And Roland, because again, money is no object. Roland goes to see Sigmund Freud and takes, excuse me, asks Freud to take him on as a patient. And Sigmund Freud wouldn't do it because he says, I'm full. So he finds out through Freud that Adler is the number two man in the world of psychiatry. Adler is number two. So he goes to see Adler. Adler won't take him on either. And Adler tells Roland that the number three man in the world of psychiatry is a man who, in Geneva, Switzerland, named Carl Jung. J-U-N-G is pronounced Jung, not Jung, not Jung, but Jung. And he goes to Switzerland to see Carl Jung. And Carl Jung agrees to hospitalize Roland. And every week for 1 year, Roland is subjected to psychoanalysis by Jung. At the end of the year, now I'm talking 1928, 29, at the end of the year, Roland is told by Jung that he can go back home to the States, and he has psychoanalyzed him and he has done everything he can do, and Roland is ready to go home. Roland goes to Paris because Paris is the first step from Geneva in getting back to the States. He goes to Paris, and who does he see in Paris? Two extremely close friends of his parents. And they say, Roland, my boy, what an unexpected treat to see you here in France. Good Lord, it's good to see you, Roland. How have you been? And Roland tells these people of his journey to Switzerland to try to get sober. And they say, oh my gosh, Roland, we must celebrate this. And he orders the man of the, this is a couple that are friends with Roland's parents. He orders a bottle of the finest French champagne that they had on ice at this restaurant, at this cafe. Roland, still not understanding anything about alcoholism, that it is permanent and it is progressive, and if untreated, it is fatal. Or as my friend Craig in Oklahoma likes to say, permanent, progressive, and fatal. Permanent, progressive, and fatal. Roland takes a drink of the champagne and he is absolutely incapacitated. He cannot even walk out of the cafe. He needs assistance to leave the restaurant, to leave the cafe. He goes back to Dr. Jung. This is 1931. He goes back to Dr. Jung and he says to Dr. Jung, "I'm drunk again. What happened?" And Dr. Jung tells him, "I have misdiagnosed you. I have misdiagnosed you. You are an alcoholic, and there is nothing that I can do for you. You are going to die, or you are going to have a wet brain, or you are going to have to go to the insane asylum." Now, if Roland had gotten to Freud or Adler, see, these guys believed that all solution lie within the mind, in the cerebral. They never considered a spiritual remedy for Roland's alcoholism. But Roland went to Jung. Is it odd or is it God? Is it odd or is it God that the one that he got to was Jung? Because Jung told Roland, here and there are people that have had what's called vital spiritual experiences, not awakenings. Now, I know I'm going to get this in the questions and answers. What's the difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening? A spiritual experience is sudden and profound. And a spiritual awakening is slower and develops over time. Now, Roland is going to be informed that there is exceptions to this death sentence, but they are very rare. He says, "Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences." Now, Bill Wilson's grandfather was the recipient of one of these things. He went up on a hike to Mount Elias in Vermont, and he had been a hopeless alcoholic his entire life. And he comes down never to drink again. Now, he was a miserable bastard because he was a dry drunk. And when you're a dry drunk, what's a dry drunk? I know I'm going to get that question. A dry drunk is someone who doesn't drink, but they're not working any steps. They're not in any type of recovery. They're not in any type of recovery. So the bottom line is that he is told that there is hope for him if he can do something to effect a spiritual experience. So, armed with this information, he goes back to New York. But before he is armed, Dr. Jung says to him, "To me, these occurrences are phenomena." Why does he use the word phenomenon? Because he didn't really understand it himself. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotion. Now, listen to how many times I'm going to refer to the concept of change. Change. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements, change, and rearrangements, change. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. Change and a completely new set of conceptions, change and motives begins to dominate them. In fact, I have been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement, change within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. So, what Roland is going back for to New York is to try to effect a change through a spiritual awake, excuse me, a spiritual experience. Now, also in its infancy, in its beginnings, is something called the Oxford Group Movement. Now, the Oxford Group Movement was not a movement or organization at any level that was designed to remedy alcoholism, not even close. The Oxford Group Movement was designed by Frank Buchman, who was a Lutheran minister. And he got a resentment against the Lutheran church. He felt very strongly that Christians, believers in Christ, had lost their enthusiasm. Now, there's a good word, enthusiasm, entheos, from God. It comes from two Greek words, entheos, from God, that they had lost their enthusiasm for Christ. And Buchman's movement, the Oxford Group movement, gets its name because he went to England to get this thing going. And while in England, what he was trying to do more than anything was to reinstill this enthusiasm for Christ. He said first century Christians were willing to be eaten by beasts, lions, tigers, what have you, to show their devotion to Christ. And he felt that modern day, this is the early part of the 20th century, modern day Christians were very blasé about their Christianity. They were very, very blasé about all of it. Now, Buchman goes on a mission to China while he's living in England, and they get their name because they were close to Oxford University, so they got the nickname the group from Oxford, near Oxford, which became the Oxford Group. They were the Oxford Group movement, not at all concerned with alcoholism, but concerned with enthusiasm for Christ. He goes to China on a mission. And while he's in China, he sees Christians who are absolutely wild about their Christianity. They are enthusiastic. They are absolutely at the pinnacle of their excitement about being Christians. And he observes that what these Christians are doing is practicing altruism. What is altruism? Altruism is giving with no expectation of a return. If you give with an expectation of a return, that is manipulation. If you give with no expectation of a return, that is true giving. In Hebrew, the word tzedakah means charity. Tzedakah means charity, but tzedakah also means to give with no expectation of a return. Tzedakah is our Yiddish word of the day, even though it's really not Yiddish, it's Hebrew. But tzedakah means to give with no expectation of return. Giving with an expectation is manipulation, it's not giving. Okay, so Buchman is in China, and he sees this altruism, working with other people, helping other people. This is the key to instilling enthusiasm for Christianity. Goes back to England and brings this altruism idea with him, and it's catching on. Now, in New York, the front man for the Oxford Group movement is a guy who is an Episcopalian minister who is now with the Oxford Group, and his name is Sam Shoemaker. Just like the shoemaker that you took your shoes to a million years ago. You don't take your shoes to a shoemaker anymore. You just throw them out, I guess. But when I was a kid, you would take your shoes to the shoemaker and get a new heel or a new sole or a new, you know, whatever. You don't do that today. It's just, you know, the gym shoes that we wear. I see people wearing gym. I wear them all the time, too. But you see people wearing them to funerals, and you see them wearing them to weddings and stuff. My, what happened to our culture? Good gravy, what happened to our culture? I was watching a funeral on TV the other day. It was on the news, but these people were at the funeral in t-shirts, baseball caps, sweatpants, and gym shoes. And I thought to myself, if my mother saw that, there would be hell to pay. That's all I would need The army and the navy wouldn't be able to save me if I went to someone's funeral in t-shirt, sweatpants, gym shoes, wearing a baseball cap. Oh, good Lord. Anyway, I'm digressing here, not deliberately so, but that's my brain. Sorry, I'm going to be 70, so you're going to have to put up with my brain. Okay, so now Buckman has instilled this enthusiasm through altruism, and Shoemaker is the man in New York. He greets Roland Hazard. Now, not this year, next year, when we're all in Newark, New Jersey for the Vision Convention, not only are you commanded to go to Stepping Stones. Stepping Stones is in Katona, it's in Westchester County. You must go to Stepping Stones, but you also should go to the Cavalry Mission. There is a stained glass window there. You walk in, you go to the left, you go to the left again. There it is. The beautiful stained glass window. And it says on the bottom, donated by Roland Hazard III. But I digress. Okay. Now, Roland goes into the Oxford Group movement in New York under Sam Shoemaker. And he's praying, and he's adapted the six tenets of the Oxford Group movement. What are the six tenets of the Oxford Group movement? We would call them steps today, would we not? We would call them steps today because that's what we've translated it to. But the six steps of the six tenets of the Oxford Group movement are complete deflation, dependence and guidance from a higher power, a moral inventory, confession, restitution, and witnessing or giving testimony to others about what Christ has done for you, what God has done for you. And that sort of translated later on into our 12 steps, but we're going to add a little more history. Not today. We're going to talk about things like the impediments, things like that. Now, the Oxford Group also had four absolutes. You were to try to be absolutely honest, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. So, in this quest to be absolutely honest, pure, unselfish, and loving by working the tenets of the Oxford Group movement, Roland Hazard is not drinking. And he meets a guy by the name of Seabrook Graves Jr., who is also alcoholic and not drinking. He doesn't know, they don't know the problem. They don't know anything about alcoholism, but they're working these tenets and they're striving for these absolutes and they're not drinking. And he meets another guy by the name of Shep Cornell. And there are three of them who are not drinking alcoholics and they're happy about it. They're happy about it. Shep, Seabra Graves Jr., and Roland Hazard are in New York at the Oxford Group at the Cavalry Mission, not drinking. Let's leave them alone for just a minute, and we're going to go up to Albany, New York. Now set your mind, set your compass, your GPS to Albany, New York. And when we're in Albany, New York, we're going to find a friend named Edwin Ebbe Thatcher. Edwin Ebbe Thatcher is an alcoholic. And he attended as a child because his family, like the Hazards, like Lois's family, the Burnhams, had a summer home in Manchester, Vermont, which was right across from East Dorset, Vermont. Now, who do we know that is from East Dorset, Vermont? Yes, whoever guessed Bill Wilson, you get a Kewpie doll. You get a Kewpie doll. Bill Wilson is from East Dorset, Vermont, and right across I was there with my sponsor a number of years ago. My sponsor drives like a Meshuggener, and you reach new vistas of prayer when he is behind the wheel. He used to be a cab driver in New York. You will say prayers you never knew you even knew when he is driving. Normally, he's on two wheels, sometimes three, seldom four. It's an adventure in terror to drive with him. But I made him promise because we were in Boston for the World Convention of OA, and we were driving to Vermont to go to this, and we loved it. We had such a good time. Oh, we had so many laughs. We were together for hours and hours going to and from East Dorset, Vermont. Oh, it was a day from heaven. It was just wonderful. Okay, now, Roland, or excuse me, Ebbie Thatcher has a summer home with his family in Manchester, Vermont. And in April of 1934, in April of 34, Ebbie Thatcher is told to go to the summer home and get it ready for us because we're coming in the summer. Now, Ebbie is a drunk. And while he's there in April of 34, he's painting a wall and some pigeons land on the gutter. And pigeons landing on the gutter, being a typical alcoholic, Ebbie goes in and gets his shotgun and he starts blasting the wall. And the police come and they put Ebbie on double secret probation. Did you ever watch Animal House? Delta House was put on double secret probation, which means that any infraction on the rules, Ebbie is going to be remanded to Brattleboro. John and I ate lunch in Brattleboro, Vermont. Brattleboro is a city in Vermont or a town, but it is also the state insane asylum. And that is what they were going to do with Ebbie. So he's told in April of 34, if the police have to come again, he is going to be remanded to Brattleboro Insane Asylum. And he's on double secret probation. Now, in late August of 1934, Ebbie has thrown caution to the wind. He is driving drunk. He is soused. He's drinking and driving while driving. He's drinking while he's driving. He's got open liquor in the car. And he drives right through a woman's kitchen. His car crashed right into her house. She scared to death. The noise was deafening. And rather than show any contrition whatsoever, Ebbie jumps out of the car. He smells like a brewery, like a distillery, jumps out of the car and says, "Hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee?" She calls the police. And in late August of 1934, Ebbie is in the lockup. And it's right before Labor Day weekend. And he stays in the lockup. Now, let Ebbie stay in the lockup for just a minute because we're going to go back to Roland. See, you thought I forgot about Roland, but I didn't. And I told you at the beginning of this, a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that Bill Wilson met Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob and Bill shook hands, and AA, as you know it today, fell out of their ear. Well, no, it doesn't work that way because Ebbie and Bill and Dr. Bob are not even involved at this point. I didn't mention their name except to tell you this, right? I didn't say anything about Bill or Bob, nothing. Now, Roland and Sebra Graves Jr., I guess Shep didn't want to go, but Sebra Graves Jr. and Roland are in Rhode Island visiting the Hazards. Roland's last name is Hazard. I can tell you that because he's dead. He's been dead since 1944. So Roland is now in Rhode Island with Sebra Graves Jr. and they're planning to go up to East Dorset because Sieber Graves Jr. says to Roland, "You've met my, or I've met your family. I would love for you to meet my family from," and Sieber Graves Jr. just happens to be from East Dorset, Vermont. Is it odd or is it God that East Dorset, Vermont, a small little, not even a town, it's like a hamlet, it's like a nothing, it's like a cab stand, it's like a nothing, it's like part of a part of a part of a town. And Sieber Graves Jr. just happens to be from there, and they're in East Dorset, Vermont, where the courthouse is, where the jail is. And on Labor Day weekend, see, if they had been there the week before, no AA. If they went the week after, no AA, I'd be dead. So they're there that Labor Day weekend, and they hear about Ebby. Now, they knew of Ebby and Ebby's drinking, and they knew that Ebby was an alcoholic drunk. I didn't know that there were drunks that weren't alcoholic, but there might be. I don't know. But he was a drunk. That's what I meant to say. And they go to the judge in early September of 1934. And they ask the judge, whose name just happens to be, wait for it, Seabrook Graves Sr. Is it odd? Or is it God that his name is Sieber Graves Sr. and Sieber Graves Jr. and Roland petitioned the judge in early September to remand Roland to their care, and they will bring Roland to the Oxford Group in New York and see if they can sober his butt up. And Roland and Sieber Graves Jr. say to the judge, "We will be responsible for him." But the judge says, "If he doesn't do exactly what you say, he is to be immediately forthwith." Forthwith means immediately. He is to be remanded forthwith back to Brattleboro and put in the insane asylum. And Ebby has a choice. He can go with these guys that are holy rollers, as he calls them, holy rollers, or he can go to the Laughing Academy. So he figures he'd rather take his chances with the holy rollers than take his chances at the Laughing Academy. And in September of 1934, Ebby Thatcher goes to New York, and from September to October, he is sober 1 month. From October to November, he is sober 2 months. This is the first 2 month period in his life since being an adult where he has remained sober. Never before in his adult life has he ever, ever remained sober. So, Shoemaker's people say to Ebby, "Ebby, you've got to go give testimony." And Ebby pictures in his mind, sometimes people get insulted by these people that come to your door and they try to give you pamphlets and tell you to join their religion or join their movement or whatever it is. My God, there's skits, comedy skits about it. And Ebby doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to do that. He says, "I don't want to go give testimony." And they say, "No problem. You'll be on the next bus to Brattleboro and we'll put you on the bus ourselves." He says, "Wait a minute. I think I'll go give testimony." Okay, good choice. So he thinks, "I raised a daughter, Winnie the Pooh." Think, 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 think. He thinks, who can he give testimony to in New York and not embarrass himself? Now, when Ebby was a boy of 10, he went to Burr and Burton Seminary School in Manchester, Vermont. Burr and Burton Seminary in 1910. It's now called Burin Burton Academy. It's not called seminary anymore. But at that time, it was a religious school. And Ebby was on the baseball team. And I'll tell you who else was on the baseball team. If you paid attention at the beginning of Bill's story, I told you that Bill Wilson found a baseball glove in Grandpa Griffith's attic. And he worked very hard and he became the co-captain of the baseball team. One of the teammates that Ebby had on that baseball team was Bill Wilson. And Bill and Ebby remained friends through the years, and they did a lot of drinking together. Now, Bill Wilson used to go around and say, "If I ever get to be as bad as Ebby, I'm going to quit drinking." And Ebby used to say, "If I ever get to be as bad as Bill Wilson, I'm going to quit drinking." And he goes to make a call on Bill Wilson in late November of 1934. But before we begin the reading, and I know I've taken up most of our time, but this is important stuff, in my opinion. It's important. I don't want to just go into the text and not give you this. This is important. Lois answered the phone when Ebby called. And she said to him, she said, "Ebby, if I find a bottle on you when you come here, you're not getting in my house." Because Ebby and Bill did a lot of drinking together. And Lois figures that the reason Ebby is calling is so he can come to Bill Wilson and they can drink until they puke and drink until they pass out. And Lois says to him, "I'm not having it. Bill was just in the hospital. He's been pronounced incurable by a doctor there, and he's not in good shape." And Ebby assures her, "Lois, I have quit drinking. I am not going to bring a bottle to your house." Based on that, it's late November. Let's go with everything we know. Let's go to the bottom of page one, of page eight, page eight. "My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober." Now that's in italics. And the reason it's in italics is because nobody ever saw Ebby in New York sober before, not since he was a child. It was like seeing Harlan Grabowski thin. I've had to prove to people that I am who I say I am. I've had to show a person from my high school class my driver's license. They were insulted when I said I was Harlan. I'm wearing a Mather shirt today. But they were insulted. They said, "That's really not funny." They said, "You know, you're an asshole," they said to me. Harlan Grabowski died years ago from a heart attack. He was the fattest kid in the school and he died. I said, "He did not die. Rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated. I am indeed him, for I can be no other." And so she laughed and said, he and she, they were married. He and she laughed, and I showed them my driver's license. And that was the only way I was going to convince them that I was who I said I was. They were a married couple from my class. Okay. Top of nine. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. See, Bill knew of some of this stuff, not all of it, but most of it. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course, he would have dinner. Then I could drink openly with him, binge buddies. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility, the very thing an oasis. Drinkers are like that. So Bill Wilson is licking his chops. He figures Lois isn't going to give him a hard time in front of Ebby, and that with Ebby there getting drunk like that, he could get drunk too and escape her wrath. This is the only thing he's thinking about. I'm in the middle of nine. The door opened and he stood there, fresh skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smilingly, he said, I've got religion. I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men, Roland Hazard and Seber Graves Jr., had appeared in court persuading the judge, Seber Graves Sr., to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. The action are the tenets, what we would call steps. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. So here was Ebbie Thatcher standing there sober. That would get anybody's attention. Do you remember Dr. Silkworth in the doctor's opinion saying to us that in order for the message to be carried, it must have depth and weight? What does that mean? That means you have to speak and understand the language of the heart. And how do you speak and understand the language of the heart? By almost dying from this disease. By almost eating yourself to death, starving yourself to death, puking yourself to death, exercising yourself to death, or going to the bathroom yourself to death. This is how you capture the language of the heart if you have a recovery from that. You cannot teach the language of the heart. You cannot teach depth and weight. You either have it or you don't. And we are the only ones that have it. So we are charged to save lives. You must recover. God needs you. God has a job for you. And you are uniquely qualified to save lives. Stop horsing around. Get serious because we need you. You are qualified to save lives. Bottom of nine, last sentence. He had come to pass his experience along to me, dash separate thought, if I care to have it. Stop trying to cram this down the throats of people who don't do what you ask them to do, who don't stay out of the food, who don't take this seriously. Work with the people that are serious. Top of 10. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly, I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. And Bill Wilson doesn't really want to die. You remember that day in Winchester Cathedral where he sees the grave of a man who drank himself to death? He doesn't want that for himself. He's a young man. He loves his wife. He's got everything to live for, yet he's dying of his untreated alcoholism. He talked for hours, top of 10. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings, his insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died, these recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. Grandpa Griffith was a good Vermonter, and he loved his religion. He loved Christ. He loved God. But he didn't want anybody to tell him how he must worship or how he must believe. And that will weave its way into the tapestry of Alcoholics Anonymous, making it possible for all of us to be here at the same time doing the same thing, because we are very different when it comes to our ideas about God, our religions, our races, our creeds, our backgrounds, our colors, our histories are different. And yet here we sit. There are 160 of you here right now. But I guarantee you, we're not all the same religion. We don't all have the same ideas. We don't all have the same thoughts. But here we are, because the disease and the recovery are universals. Very, very important. It's page 10, middle of the page, that wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. And he's thinking about the witnessing he did of this doggerel on a tombstone of a man who drank himself to death named Edward Thatcher, like Ebby Thatcher, but Thatcher. And he says, I had always believed in a power. Notice power is capitalized. He's talking about God. Greater than myself, I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher. A cipher is an empty set and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much a precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe, capitalized, spirit of the universe, who knew neither time nor limitation. But that was as far as I had gone. And how many of us can relate to this? Remember, the idea behind Bill's story is, do you think like Bill thinks? I do. Do you eat like Bill drinks? I do. Can I relate to Bill Wilson? I do. I do. Do I relate? Yes. Because when this was presented to me as a God solution, I bristled. I believed in God. I believed in the force of the world that split the Sea of Reeds, which is misinterpreted as the Red Sea, but that's okay. That's for another time. I believe in the burning bush. I believe in the Ten Commandments. I believe in the Torah. I believe that it is given by God. But I knew that God hated me. I knew it. I knew God hated my guts. If he didn't hate me, why did he make me fat instead of thin? Why did he make me poor instead of rich? Why did he make me who I was instead of anybody else? I wanted to, what was my greatest ambition? To die. But I wanted to be anybody else other than who I was. I wanted to be anybody else, because I thought if I was anybody else, I'd have a chance. I was scared to death of this world. I knew no instructions. I had no guidance. My mother and father were just hanging on. They were just trying to stay alive. They couldn't parent me in that sense. They gave me some things, but they couldn't. I got what I got more by watching Andy Griffith and the Dick Van Dyke Show and the Beverly Hillbillies than I got at home. And I got a lot from the parents of my friends. That's how I got raised. Huckleberry Hound was as much my father as anybody else. Yogi Bear, whoever, Boo Boo Bear, whatever. I didn't know how to live in this world. I knew there was a God, and I knew that God was omnipotent. He created Lake Michigan. He created the Great Lakes. He created the world. I knew there was a God. That wasn't a debate of mine, but why did he hate me? What string of felonies did I commit neonatally before I was born that condemned me to a life as a fat boy? What did I do? And I had no explanation. I just knew I was bad. Existentially, I was bad. So I figured that's what God wants. F God. F God. Screw him. I was mad at him. A lot of people that say, I'm an atheist or I'm an agnostic. Some are. I'm not disputing that. I'm not challenging that. That's not my job to challenge that. But some of the people who say that, the reason that they're saying that is they believe that there's a God. They're just pissed off as hell. They're pissed off at hell, as hell at that God that they figure screwed them over. When I went to Hebrew school, that God had nothing to do with me. That God was not a God that was personal to me. It took me decades in these rooms to develop a personal relationship with a power greater than myself. And that takes a lot of work on my part. The God of Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses and Aaron and Adam and Eve and all the rest of them and Noah told God off, hey, what'd you do that for? What were you thinking? But anyway, Noah's an interesting category. But that's aside. So that God had nothing to do with me, not according to what I knew. What did that God have to do with me? And I'm growing up in a family where my father's parents and brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews and grandparents and cousins were murdered in Europe. And for what reason? For what reason? For what reason were these people obliterated off the face of the earth? Murdering my family? Why? I had no explanation for it. And I'm growing up with a father that says, one day they will come to kill you. And if they don't kill you, they'll kill your children because that's what they do. It isn't a question of when this is going to happen or if it's going to happen again, it's when. And I'm growing up in this. This is how I'm growing up. This is my teacher. This is my father. And I'm scared to death. He's scaring the daylights out of me. And now I have to believe in this God. Well, what I learned is I can take a positive road. I can take a positive road. Last Wednesday, I learned things about myself that hopefully will change some of my behaviors. During my life, I learn things that improve my life. I don't have to sit and stew about anything with God. I can have a relationship with God that is both positive and productive, that He's personal to me. Now, that didn't come in 1 minute. It didn't come as the result of one conversation. It came about as the result of a long, protracted, years-long effort that continues to this day. And we're going to finish one more paragraph. And then next week, we are going to start on a paragraph that is as timeless as the mountains. I'm at the bottom of 10. With ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him, him as capital, his moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. Okay. Now, we're going to start next week on page 11, and we're going to start with a paragraph that is timeless. Timeless. And I hope you will all come back next week. But before you go away, we are going to have questions and answers. And I'm going to ask you once again that you make sure you know what you're asking, because sometimes you, some of you don't know what you're asking. I'm not even going to say if you asked a question last week, step back, because sometimes it's okay. If you have a legitimate question, even if you asked one last week, it's okay, because a lot of times we're just sort of searching around to see who's, you know, got one. So if you asked a question last week, wait for a lull in the action. Don't refrain from asking, but just wait for a lull in the action. And as always, no food questions, no math. Although I'm still thinking, last night I was thinking about this. Man, I want to take that math class. I do. I really, truly do. There's a community college. There's a couple of them, but I was across the street from one last night, and I'm thinking, man, I just want to see how I could do. I just want to take it and see how I could do. Okay. I don't know if it's Sue. I don't know who it is. Sue, I'm going to turn it back to you. Or Dottie. Dottie or Sue, I'm going to turn it back to you. Or Nancy.
Okay. Or thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to stop the recording.